Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Well, here's a twist. On this episode of Southbound, the guest is me. The great Mike Collins, the host of WFAE's Charlotte Talks, interviewed me about my new book, Dogland. The book's about the Westminster Dog Show and the deep bond between dogs and their people. Mike always asks thoughtful questions, and I did my best to give him good answers. Next episode, we'll be back to our regular format. But for now, here's our conversation.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When you are a writer like WFAE's Tommy Tomlinson, everything in your life is possible fodder for that writing. For instance, a while back, Tommy was watching one of those competitive dog shows on TV when he wondered, are those show dogs happy? Well, that led to a three-year trek around the country, going behind the scenes at dog shows and following the career of one dog in particular, Striker. The result is Tommy's latest book, Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. It also led to some discoveries about the secret lives of dogs and maybe even an answer to the question, are those show dogs happy? Tommy Tomlinson is here and joins us for the hour.
Hey Mike.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. You were, as I said, watching this dog show on TV a couple of years ago and asked the question to yourself, are those dogs happy? And when I read that, what popped into my head were these little kitty pageants, these little toddler pageants. And because I've always wondered, are these little girls in these pageants happy? Is there any similarity?
Oh, I think there's definitely a similarity. They are, you know, these dogs are chosen from the time they're puppies.
Yeah.
You know, there's a litter of a purebred dogs. The breeders go through and they pick some of the dogs as show quality, which means they have a chance to be champions. The other dogs are considered pet quality, which is sort of a dig in that world. It's only good enough to be a pet. From the moment those dogs are chosen to show quality, they are treated differently than any other dog. They are trained, they're fed differently, they're groomed, they're taught to be, you know, all the nuances of the show ring. And then they spend, in many cases, 5 or 6 years going around the country in dog shows. It's just a very different life. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that what also struck me as I read through your book is that these dogs, they don't know that they're show dogs.
Right. Well, and I think that is a difference between...
But the toddlers don't know either. That's all they know.
Right. I think there is a difference between in self-awareness, right? Even a little kid in a beauty pageant might look at some kid just playing in the dirt or something and go, well, why can't I have that life?
Yeah.
Dogs, I don't think, have that same sort of self-awareness. But the show dog definitely leads a different life than your average pet.
The show you were watching on television is probably the most famous of all the dog shows in this country, the Westminster Dog Show in New York, and you compare it to both Wimbledon and the Super Bowl in terms of what that means. And there must be thousands of dog shows that lead to that level that get both the dogs and the handlers ready. How extensive is the dog show circuit?
Everywhere in America, across America on a given weekend, there are 5 or 6 big dog shows that will have anywhere from 500 to 2,000 dogs in each one. They're often in smaller places like a little civic arena or a convention center. Sometimes it'll be like at a fairgrounds or like a livestock arena or something like that. But the top show dogs will often be at these smaller shows because to make it to the big shows, you have to accumulate championship points. And the way you accumulate championship points is by winning those smaller shows.
Like NASCAR.
It's very much like NASCAR. to be the champion of the end, you got to win at Talladega or Bristol or somewhere. And so these show dogs you know, show up. Usually the owners or the handlers take them around the country in RVs or Sprinter vans or something like that. And so you'll see these at a little, you know, livestock arena. You'll see like 500 RVs. I sort of compared it to deadheads in a way. You know, they just follow this circuit around the country, except instead of like LSD and falafel, they're, you know, traveling on Big Macs and box wine.
Yeah. How many of the, you spent 3 years going around to these dog shows, exploring the world, getting to understand, and then following this dog Striker and Striker's handler. How many, I know you're independently wealthy because of the salary that we pay you here at WFAE, but how many of these dog shows did you go to?
Well, they do them in clusters. So if you think of like a golf tournament as being 1 4-day-long tournament, dog shows are the opposite. They are 4 1-day-long dog shows all in the same place. So like there's a dog show in Concord up the road here, and that weekend they'll have the Concord Kennel Club, the Hickory Kennel Club, the Charlotte Kennel Club, or whatever. They'll have 4 shows back to back to back to back. So if you count that as 4 events,
right,
I probably went to 100 shows or more. Wow. All over the country.
You say that anybody who works for the Westminster Dog Show will tell you that, often repeatedly, you say, that the Westminster is the second longest-running annual sporting event in American history, behind only the Kentucky Derby. Okay, but is it really a sport?
Well, I think it depends on your definition of sport. I've tossed this in my head quite a bit. It certainly is a sport for the dogs. There's physical activity. Mm-hmm. The handlers do have to do a little running. I think the key thing is, do the athletes know they're participating in a sport? You know? And I think by that standard, it's probably not a sport. But there certainly are physical characteristics, physical, you know, the way the dogs move and all that sort of thing. Their physicalness is part of what's being judged in a dog show.
You spent 3 years investigating this. This is a world. I mean, it's a world unto itself. It's Absolutely. Like any other hobby or club activity. The people involved in it are highly invested in all of it, monetarily and emotionally invested. So it's a whole world, and they have a whole language, and they all understand each other, and some people hate each other, I'm sure, and there are these rivalries, etc. But how would you describe what you saw behind the scenes at these dog shows?
Well, like you said, it is a subculture, and everybody's got something, whether you knit or fish or whatever. We all have something that looks maybe absurd from the outside, but if you're on the inside, it makes perfect sense. So the world of dog shows is very much about what they call confirmation. So technically in a dog show, the dogs are not competing against one another. They are competing against the standard for their breed that describes basically what the perfect version of their breed should be like. So when you see like the best in show round and you're seeing a bloodhound versus a poodle versus a Pekingese or whatever, they're really not competing against each other. They're not supposed to be. They're competing against what the perfect bloodhound should be and how close they get to that. Mm. And so that sort of...
And who makes that decision?
Well, there are breed clubs for every breed, and they do written breed standards, which can be very long. I mean, they can be like 5,000 words, you know, of like describing in minute detail what the eyes should look like and how high a dog should be and how their fur should look and all those sorts of things. And if you don't meet those standards, you're disqualified. Mm. And so that whole notion of that there is like a purest version of a dog possible, it's a little eugenics kind of thinking a little bit. Ew. But also it's a quest for kind of perfection. And I think a lot of the people in the fancy, which is inside the dog world, that's why they call it the fancy. It's all about trying to make the most perfect dog possible.
In the book, here's how you describe what you saw on TV that day, the thing that kicked all of this off. You quote, the dogs didn't do anything. They definitely didn't do anything they were bred to do. Instead, dog after dog, little dogs meant to catch rats, medium dogs built to hunt birds, giant dogs made to pull sleds or guard castles, pranced around a show ring accompanied by handlers wearing either the blandest outfits possible or something from the Elton John collection. How did these happen? How did these competitions come to be? How did how did the job of handler become a job?
Good question. So dog shows in general, what we know of as dog shows started about 150, 160 years ago in England, where people who had hunting dogs would get together and they would talk about their dogs. And at some point, somebody decided to get them together and they would look at them and see which ones they thought were best. That translated in the late 1800s to America, a group of guys who went to this old hotel in New York called the Westminster, which is how Westminster got its name, started talking about their hunting dogs and comparing them. And so they didn't have the first dog show in America, but it was one of the first. And it was the first one to sort of have big crowds and name a best in show and all that sort of thing. And they held it at what we know now as Madison Square Garden in New York. And it was in Madison Square Garden for well over 100 years, up until just recently. From the very beginning, it was a huge success. And as more dog breeders, as more dog lovers wanted their dogs to be part of that show, they added more and more and more breeds. And so now at Westminster, there are somewhere around 200 breeds that compete. And usually that translates to somewhere around 2,500 dogs.
I was going to ask you when this became a book, whether it was before you actually started this investigation or you started it because you knew you wanted it to be a book. But this is a book, it strikes me, that has incredible sales potential, because anybody who has a dog, who has ever had a dog, who is a dog lover, is going to love this book.
Well, thank you. I about half the households in America own a dog.
Right.
If they all buy the book, I'm in good shape.
You're in great shape.
I'm in great shape. Yeah. And so there are, you know, beyond that, there are lots of people who are involved in the world of dog shows and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, there are many, many dogs are far and away the most popular pet in America and have been forever.
Tommy Tomlinson is our guest. His book is called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. You call the book Dogland. Why? Where did the name come from?
After I started wandering around the country following these dog shows around, it kind of felt like this portable theme park to me. Because every time I would land somewhere, it was a different place, but everything looked the same. All these RVs out in the parking lot, all the show rings in there. There's always like a big row of people selling leashes and, you know, T-shirts and all that stuff. There's like a souvenir stands, basically. And it just reminded me of like a theme park. And so I started in my head calling it Dogland. Dogland could be kind of wherever you want it to be. And it's somewhere different every week. But that's kind of the way I started thinking about it.
You started this, as we said, because you were watching that Westminster dog show on television. And the question popped into your head, are these show dogs happy? And that morphed into, are pet dogs happy? Which morphed into an exploration of the relationship that humans have with these animals. It's really a symbiotic relationship. They make us happy. We allegedly make them happy. And I'm going to ask you later on in this conversation whether you think that is, in fact, the case. But it's clear what's happening, I think, on the dog's end to some degree with us. We give them food and a warm place to be, to sleep, etc. Is it clear to you on the human end whether we are getting whether we believe that they are happy or that we are being conned?
Well,
I'm not sure that was a clear question, but go ahead.
Anybody who's ever had a dog beg for treats know that there's a con involved at some level. But I think what dogs have done for us over the years, first of all, that relationship has gone on, some scientists think, as long as 30,000 years.
Right.
Dogs were all descended from gray wolves. And since then, they have been our partners, are the first animal we ever tamed. And in some ways, they've tamed us.
Yes, I'm going to get into that when we come back, because you say that dogs and humans domesticated each other. We'll talk about that with Tommy Tomlinson in a moment. His book is called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show.
Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time.
Tommy Tomlinson is with us this morning. He has written yet another book. His writing, if you've never read Tommy, he is one of the best writers I have ever read. Your books are just, they're like the cherry on top of an ice cream sundae.
Thank you, Mike.
It's wonderful.
I'll be giving you your endorsement.
Thank you.
Later.
A little dog treat would be nice. His latest book is called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. And you say, as we said just a moment ago, that dogs and humans domesticated each other. Explain that.
So as early humankind needed different things. So the first dogs that they bred, you know, humans basically invented the dog out of gray wolves. And as early on, they basically made dogs as power tools. They needed dogs to like pull sleds and to hunt game and to do all these like big physical hard labor jobs. The fact that dogs could do that enabled humans to settle down a little bit, to stop being nomads, to build homesteads, to start farming and those sort of things, to domesticate other animals like cattle and goats and right. That sort of thing. And then as people moved off the farms and into factories, into homes, sometimes leaving their families at home while they worked, those people needed companionship, they needed friends, and dogs moved indoors at some point. And now, as you think about how people live today, most dogs live indoors most of the time. Mm-hmm. They, as I say in the book, they're kind of all therapy dogs now. And dogs have enabled humans to evolve, change their lifestyle, change their way of living, change their way of doing things. And so without dogs, our evolution and our rate of change in our lives may have been much slower.
You use a word in this book prolifically, because they use it prolifically at dog shows that we don't use prolifically on the radio, although it is said on television now.
It's time, Mike.
It's time. So I'm going to warn parents who may be listening with their children that we're about to say the B word a little bit, not as much as they throw it around at dog shows.
Yeah.
But the B word is the B-I-T-C-H word.
Yes.
And that's really where it came from. It's the word for a female dog. But you point something out in this, because they throw that around a lot, that B word. There is no commensurate word for a male dog. A male dog is a dog. So is that what's that about?
I have a couple of suggestions in the book that we'll leave alone. But yes, so in the dog show world, the word bitch is not considered to have any negative connotation
right.
at all. It's just a female dog. I remember when I first walked into a dog show and I heard over the PA system, like, would the, you know, German Shepherd bitches report to Ring 4 or whatever? And I was startled. But I realized pretty quickly that is just that's just the way that people in that bubble talk, and they don't think about it twice. And so I have a little kind of warning at the beginning of my book that this word is going to pop up quite a bit during the book, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in the dog show world, it has no negative meaning at all.
Hmm. You mentioned, and we've talked about this a little bit, that these dogs don't really do anything. They just trot around with their handler on a leash.
Or, yeah.
But they're being judged, as you point out, for best in breed or whatever it is. Who set up the criteria? What is the criteria? And I know from having been involved in ice skating shows, which are judged, the competitions are judged. You live and die by, you know, 10 8.
Right.
And there's criteria for that. But sometimes it's very political and people get very upset about certain judges. So is that similar to what's going on
here? I think there is some of that. There is certainly a book on every judge. Like some dog handlers will go to one show instead of another if they're competing shows on a given weekend because they think one particular judge will be better or worse for their dog than another. And there is, every top handler, every, champion dog owner knows the tendencies of every judge. In the same way that, like, baseball umpires have tendencies, dog show judges have tendencies. They might tend to pick bigger dogs over smaller ones, that sort of thing.
And the same is true in football, where there are refs and things like that. But there is also the score. You either make the touchdown or you don't.
Right. It's not like boxing where you knock out your opponent.
Right.
You have to be judged. And I think there's a difference between the technical part of it and the practical part of it. Technically, as I mentioned before, these dogs are supposed to be judged against their breed standard.
Right.
And in theory, at least, the dog that wins best in show is the dog that most closely resembles the perfect version of that breed. But I will tell you that as a practical matter, there are things like energy and charisma and those sorts of things that play into it. Like I'm still, after doing this for a long time, I was not a great dog judge, but I could look at a group of dogs in a breed and make a pretty decent guess about which one might win, not because of its breed standard, but because of like the energy and joie de vivre it was showing.
This is where the dog shows are kind of like March Madness, because everybody has their brackets for March Madness, and it all leads up to the final game. And at these competitions, as you write about them, every dog is judged against its breed, and the winner of that moves on, and then this to best of show. Are they all judged by the same group of people through those series of events up to best of show?
No, there's a different group of judges at every level. So there will be one judge. A dog show goes to three levels. First of all, they're judged in a breed, and then they're judged in a group. The 200 or so breeds are split into seven groups. And then the winner of each of those groups competes for best in show. And at each level, they will face a different judge. In fact, at Westminster, the best in show judge is sort of sequestered like a juror. He or she does not know who the last seven dogs are until they walk into the room. They're like sequestered away. They're brought over in a limo. They're wearing a tux. There's a lot of showmanship in this. And they're brought in the tux and they, walk into the room, and that's the first time they see the dog.
But these judges do the circuit too.
Oh, sure.
So chances are they have seen many of these dogs before. Do their judgments of those dogs change over time?
Well, that depends on who you ask a lot of times. And there's a lot of unofficial lobbying of judges in the sense that there are trade magazines that cover the dog show business. And in every one of those trade magazines, they are jammed full of what's similar to those for-your consideration ads that you might see in the Hollywood magazines around Oscar time.
Yep.
So there'll be these glossy pictures of the dog and the dog handler, and they'll always make sure, if they want to show somewhere, to thank that judge for judging them in that show. The idea being that if a judge is judging a breed and there are like 25 dogs that all look similar, they might remember that ad and say, some other judge like that, maybe I will too.
There's politics in everything.
Oh, sure.
You say that you love, and I do too, the dog show mockumentary, Best in Show, which was the Christopher Guest show and movie. I can't remember the name of Catherine
O'Hara.
O'Hara.
Yes.
Who both did another word we're not going to say on the radio, but the one with the creek in the title.
Yes.
But I've seen all of their films, and they are brutally funny because they're so honest and true. Did you find the world of these dog shows to be at all similar to what we see in Best of Show?
Oh, sure. I think one of the brilliant things about all those mockumentaries that they do is that they're based in the reality.
Yes.
And in fact, in Best in Show, they hired real dog judges and dog handlers to be sort of in the crowd and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of verisimilitude in how those dog shows look in that movie. In the dog show world, it's kind of a split decision. There are a lot of people who still feel a little stung by that movie, even though it's almost 25 years old now. There are others who are able to take a step back and outside the bubble, I guess, a little bit, and see it for the, I think it's lovingly mocked way that it was presented. And so it can be a sore subject with some people in the dog show.
Because I got to tell you, Waiting for Guffman, I think that's the name of it. That is the theater. Dead on for amateur theater.
Sure.
Dead on. There is no prize money at Westminster, which actually shocked me. You write about that in the book, that you get a pewter trophy or a glass bowl or something like that, and you say that the owners of these dogs who travel this circuit and spend a lot of money to do it, and I guess there's an entrance fee, they are not necessarily wealthy. They're just ordinary people, many of them, most of them. But I'm going to wager that this is not a cheap sport.
It is not. I think hiring a top handler to do what they call a campaign, which is trying to take a show dog and make it a champion, that can run into the six figures in costs every year when you hire a top handler. I got varying reasons from people on why they did it. There are wealthy, like Martha Stewart's had dogs in the dog show, Barry Bonds, people like that. Certainly very wealthy people have had show dogs in Westminster. But a lot of people haven't. The owners of Stryker are not super wealthy themselves. One reason they gave me was like, it's like sending a promising kid off to a really good university. You know, you're doing something you hope will bring rewards beyond whatever money you spent. But the thing that struck me the most, and the thing that I think is closest, a handler told me early on that think about it like owning a really great piece of art. Nobody else in the world has it. You get to show it off to everyone. And the value of that art in your heart is far more than what you paid for.
Well, that answers my next question, because I was going to ask you what's in it for the owners, because they don't, for the most part, they're not in the ring with it. Some of them are the handlers, but most of them are not the handlers. So they're not in the ring with the dog. They are usually separated from their own dogs because they have to be with the handlers for a long period of time for training so that they'll do what the handlers expect them to do, et cetera. So what's in it for them? They don't get any prize money either. So what's in it for them?
Yeah, I think there is some dog breeding that goes on where some people can make some money. It's not anything, though, like horse breeding where, you know, a really big-time horse can, you know, get stud fees of millions of dollars. That doesn't exist really in the dog show world. But I do think it's that it's people who love dogs. They want to spend their money on something. A couple of them said to me, you know, we could spend our money on vacations. We could spend our money on, you know, a fancy house, lots of other things. This is our thing. This is how we choose to spend our money.
When you watch these dog shows, there are these handlers in the ring with the dogs. What is their function?
A handler is the person who, I think, has a connection with a dog, makes a connection with a dog that enables it to perform its best in the show ring.
Which and consists of what?
Well, it consists of a lot of times just being still, because in the time that your dog is in the show ring, there are lots of other dogs too.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of behave. But then when it comes time for the judge to see you, you have to do lots of things. A judge looks at lots of things. There's a thing called a stack, which is sort of a pose that a dog forms. And if a dog forms that stack and is still and holds it there, that counts for a lot. Those dogs are sort of poked and prodded. And with male dogs, their male parts are checked to make sure everything's intact because these dogs are bred. That's part of the reason they do these shows, is to provide breeding stock.
Mm-hmm.
And so dogs have to hold still during that. And then as they run around the ring, the idea is that they're paying attention to what the handler is doing and not losing their concentration. And if you think about a regular dog, how easily distracted they are by any shiny object, it takes a lot of training to get a dog to the point where it can perform like that.
I would guess that if you are a person who has a dog that you'd like to put into dog shows and you're a novice, you have to shop around for a handler.
You do.
Or learn to do it yourself, I suppose. But talk about the relationship between the owners and the handlers and the dogs.
So the owners look for handlers, just like judges have tendencies, like particular dogs they may like or not like. There are handlers who are really good with certain types of dogs. Okay. So Laura King, who is the handler, who's sort Stryker. Of the star of this book, Stryker's handler, is really good with kind of bigger dogs, like Stryker, who's a Samoyed, sort of a Siberian Husky type dog. She's really good with those types of dogs. Her owners were, Stryker's owners were in Canada, brought Stryker to the U.S. to do U.S. shows because they're more prestigious, and hooked up with Laura because she is known as one of the best in the world.
So these handlers are kind of like coaches.
Oh, yeah.
For gymnasts or ice skaters, or they're the coaches.
That's exactly the analogy, except the coaches are also in the ring at the same time
right.
with the dogs
right.
when it comes showtime. Laura, in Stryker's case, saw immediately that she had a real potential champion on her hands. And so at any given time, she might be working with 15 or 20 dogs, but she really laser-focused in on Stryker to build that connection with him so that when she kind of like when she had a thought, he knew what she was thinking.
It sounds very clinical and professional and because they're there to do a job, both the handler and the dog, but you say that it's not. It's not clinical. There's a lot of affection.
Well, on one level, these dogs are commodities in a sense. They're shuttled in and out of the ring, and they are bought and sold and all that sort of thing. But many people in the dog show world mentioned to me the concept of a heart dog. And that's the one that no matter how many dogs you've had in your life, you always remember the most fondly. And I think even though Laura had a little bit of a hard time admitting this, Stryker is her heart dog. Stryker was the one that she, in her entire career, has made sort of the deepest connection with.
I would think if you're a successful show dog, you're going to spend most of your time with your handler, not with your owner.
Right. Early on, certainly. Yeah, they get sent over. But at some point, they all go back.
Yeah, because the life of, it's kind of like a ballet dancer or any professional athlete. The life, evidently, of a show dog is brief. As a show dog, and they continue life after they stop going to these shows. But why? Why is it brief? Why can't you just keep doing it?
The life of a show dog is probably 4 or 5 years. After that, aging happens to dogs faster than it does to humans. Their joints get a little stiff. Their hair changes color. They become not quite as easily trained. They become more distracted. And judges and people in the show dog world can see that more quickly than the rest of us.
So because they spend so much time with their handler, when their time in the ring is over, sounds like a boxer,
right.
When their time in the ring is over, how difficult is that on the handler? How difficult is it on the dog?
It's very difficult on the handler for sure, especially when the dog is really important to them. And I have a scene in my book that describes just that, and it's difficult for everybody involved.
Tommy Tomlinson's our guest. The book is called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. We're going to talk more about Stryker and his handler and about Fred, who was Tommy's dog, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Tommy Tomlinson this morning, WFAE's Tommy Tomlinson, about his latest book, Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. I want to talk some more about these handlers and separation anxiety from the dogs with which they have worked so hard over time. These dogs are separated. There is some separation because there is an affection between these dogs and their handlers. But then they go back to their owners. Do they know their owners? Do the dogs have the same affection for the owners and vice versa?
Whether they have the same affection is something beyond my understanding.
Okay.
But certainly they see their owners. The owners will often come to the dog shows, especially the big ones, and spend time with the dogs. In fact, sometimes the dogs will like spend the night with the owners or something like that instead of spending the night with the handlers. So they do know there's these other people in their life. And as you know, as a friend of mine used to say when they would dog sit our dog, you know, once I feed your dog twice, it's my dog now. You know, dogs have a affinity for whoever is like
feeding them.
Yeah.
It's the con.
Yeah, exactly. But certainly I think there is a connection, and a handler, the best handlers, are really good at forming that connection. And so that separation can be really heart-wrenching.
So you went to hundreds of these dog shows, and you follow one dog's journey through this process, Stryker, and his handler, as you said, Laura King. How did you choose Stryker and Laura, or maybe you chose one and the other came along, but how did you choose them and make them your key subject?
It was more about the handler than the dog. I was looking for certainly a dog that could contend for the championship at Westminster, because I wanted to follow a dog as I kind of went through that process. And that narrowed it down to maybe, I ended up talking to 10 or 12 handlers. Some of them were just super busy, didn't have time to talk to me. Others were sort of wary of outsiders, as anybody in a subculture is. You don't want somebody to come in and do a best in show and make fun of the whole process. Laura King stood out for me because she is a die-hard dog show person. She loves dogs. She loves that work. She can also step back from it, be a little detached, see the absurdities of it, laugh at that, and be a good guide for me into this world. So it took quite a while to find her and talk to her and realize that she was the one I wanted to follow around.
She's clearly good at what she does.
She's excellent.
So what is it that she does, and how did she become good at it? And do you take training to be a handler? How does that work?
For Laura, she learned to walk by holding her dog's tail, the family dog.
Really?
And she has wanted to do this ever since she was old enough to say what she wanted to do. I think in college briefly after college, she was an accountant for a couple of years, but that didn't take. She always wanted to be a dog handler. Her mom got a dog when Laura was a little kid, and the person who gave her the dog said, you can have this dog, but you have to show it. And so Laura and her mom went around to dog shows. So Laura's been in the dog show world ever since she was small. She has a real sense of what a dog wants, what it needs, and how to make that happen. And I think that's why she's so coveted. I mean, people line up to have her work with their dogs.
I said sometime at the beginning of this that these handlers, and you said in the book that these handlers sometimes look like Elton John. Sometimes they're wearing the blandest outfits possible. It actually surprised me, because every time I ever have seen a dog show on TV, the handlers are dressed, I don't mean this pejoratively, but they're rather dowdy.
Right.
And I assumed that it's because they want to disappear, that the star is the dog. They don't want the focus on them. So it kind of surprised me that some of these people dress like Elton John.
Well, there's a bit of a dichotomy there.
Yeah.
So there's some people, you're exactly right, want to be as invisible as possible because they want all the focus on the dog. There is a train of thought also, though, that if the handler is really showy and looks really sparkly and all that, it might get the judge to remember the dog more.
Mm.
I found, and as I watched, and somebody was dressed like that, I remembered the handler but not the dog. But there's, you know, two trains of thought on that. There are difficulties for dog handlers, especially women, and this one is that they're trying around the ring, and so you kind of have to wear flats. And so there's not many outfits that look good with flats that they can choose. Mm. The second is pockets, because all dog handlers carry around treats of some kind in their pockets. And if a dress or a particular suit doesn't have pockets, sometimes dog handlers, the women, stuff it down their bra, and a lot of the handlers, male and female, actually stuff the treats in their mouth, like a wad of chewing tobacco or something, and they pull them out and feed them to the dog as they're going around the ring and that sort of thing. So treat storage is a bone of contention, so to speak, in this world.
I would have felt much better if I never knew that. Tell us about Stryker. What kind of a dog was he? What struck you about Stryker?
So Stryker, as I said, is a Samoyed, a brilliantly white, looks kind of like a snowman come to life in a sense. White fur, black eyes, black nose. And what I noticed about him at first was his sort of zen-like stillness. When there are 25 Samoyeds in a ring, and they're all, many of them are like jumping around, or they're looking around, or they're like distracted, or they're bouncing, and their handles are, Stryker was like almost like a statue. And as I say in the book, sometimes I associate that with people who are enlightened. Sometimes I associate that with people who are sort of empty-headed. Mm-hmm. But Stryker had this like great calmness about him that I think made him a good show dog. Because when the time came for him to show off in the ring, he could do that. But when he wasn't needed to do that, he just sort of like found his center in a way. And that's wow. Something that stuck out to me watching him as compared to a lot of the other dogs.
Something else about these dog shows, I never knew this. I just assumed that they were backstage until they trotted themselves out to be in the ring, and then they went backstage again and they got put in a cage and they hauled off. But at these dog shows, you say that spectators can meet the dogs. They can go backstage. They can pet the dogs as long as you pet them in the right way, because some of these dogs have been dolled up and sprayed within an inch of their lives. Talk about that experience. And is that where the slobber comes in?
Absolutely. So the kind of rule of thumb, I had to learn this from a couple of handlers early on. If a dog comes up to you, you come up to a dog, ask the handler, it's okay to pet them. Mm-hmm. But if you pet them, don't pet them on top of the head because they've been groomed very carefully, mm-hmm. and you don't want to like mess that up. So you go for the like under the chin scritch. And even the most, you know, elegant dog is going to have a little slobber. Mm-hmm. And so that you're going to get that on your hand. It's just a fact of life in dog shows. But yeah, they are all groomed to within an inch of their lives. Some dogs I found a couple of times as I was walking around the dog floor, like hair extensions and that sort of thing. Some things that sort of push the boundaries of what's legal and not. But they're all, you know.
So it is like NASCAR.
A little bit. Yeah, that's right. You don't want to get sent to the hauler. But yeah, they're pushing the envelope, and they're also meticulously grooming these dogs. A dog like Stryker to be bathed, hair dried and groomed could take several hours a day.
My gosh. So we know where the slobber comes from. Yes. Now in the title. Where's the passion come from? Is it the handlers, the owners, the spectators?
I think some of all. I mean, I think the handlers are certainly deeply into this stuff. The spectators, many of whom are people who just love dogs, may have their own dogs that they show like at the local level, that sort of thing. I mean, you don't go to a dog show. There can be a long, tedious day at a dog show.
Right.
Making less like 12 hours.
Wow.
You don't go to that unless you really love dogs. And so the people who come usually are very passionate about their dogs. And then the owners, too, some of them, you know, own dogs like a piece of art, but others are very much into it, and they sweat and have nerves and, you know, agonize over every decision where their dog either moves forward or doesn't. It's a huge winnowing. You know, you start out with, at Westminster, about 2,500 dogs. There's only one winner.
Wow. You, these dogs are all highly trained. And you say in the book, most of them have spent nearly their whole lives either at dog shows or traveling to them. And you say, we can't tell what they're thinking, which leads back to the original question. Right. Are these dogs happy? Years ago, it was perfectly respectable for people to go and enjoy the lion tamer at the circus or elephants doing tricks for our amusements. Now, that's pretty much disappeared. Even zoos are coming into question. What about these dog shows? Is there an equivalent here?
I think a lot of researchers and scientists would say yes. And in fact, some of them would go so far as to say we shouldn't have dogs as pets.
Really?
Because we are confining them. They don't have an agency in their lives. They're not choosing to be with us. We brought them into our house and we kept them there. And so I think at the edges of this thinking about dog behavior and the dog-human relationship, there is some thought that we kind of screwed up from the beginning by breeding dogs and making them do our bidding in a way. I think
Are we being too woke when we think
like
that?
Well, I think to mix the animal metaphors, the horse is out of the barn on that. I mean, that's the way things are now.
Yeah.
I think dogs certainly get things from us that they would not have if they were all out on the street. They get security. They get comfort. They probably lead longer lives. Mm. And they get the joy, I believe, of that companionship with human beings. There's many, many studies that look at whether dogs and people really do get happiness from each other. I remember one study that a dog and a human, when they look at each other, they both get a dose of oxytocin, which is sort of like the pleasure enzyme. Mm-hmm. And so not just the humans are getting it, the dogs are getting it too. So I think to come around to the original question, we do make each other happy, certainly. I think the form of that happiness may be different for dogs and for us because they're just different creatures.
Right.
We can't anthropomorphize them. The way they think and the way they behave and the way they see the world is different than us and unknowable to us. And we just have to do the best we can by providing them our affection and our love and our treats and hope that that's enough.
Stryker has a strikingly simple name.
Yes.
If I understand what you wrote about in this book correctly, because these dogs at these dog shows usually do not. It's not unlike the names for horses, which are short, but they're not names that you would name your horse if you owned your horse. And the same is true for these dogs. What are some of the names that you encountered?
Oh, man. So Stryker actually does have a long name. Every dog has a what they call a registered name, which is what they register with the AKC. And that is usually starts out with the where the dog was bred plus whatever little filigrees the owners and breeders like to put on the end. So Stryker's full name, he had two breeders, and so it was Vanderbilt and Printemps Lucky Strike. That was his registered name. But many dogs have much, much longer names. I have some in the book. There's like, you know, She Sells Seashells by the Seashore kind of dogs and that sort of thing. And I remember there was one that was named for Bohemian Rhapsody. There are just tons of these names out there. And it got to be to the point where the AKC said you have to limit it to like 50 characters because people are just going crazy. And so every dog has that registered name. But then they also have a call name, like you would call your dog, you know, Spike or Fido or whatever. They all have their own names that you just call them by as well.
You said that we bring these dogs into our home. They don't necessarily want to be here. But your dog, Fred, that you write about in this book, you found him essentially in a gutter.
He was in the ditch in the front yard of our house. Went out to get the paper one morning. He was there, a little puppy.
And a little puppy, defenseless, probably hadn't been fed in a long time. And you brought him in and got him all his shots, and he became your dog. And you fill this book with dog facts, but that's where the rubber meets the road, it seems to me, when you talk about your own dog and your relationship with Fred and what it meant to you and your wife and how difficult it was when Fred passed on.
Yeah, so we had him 14 and a half years and was just a total joy in our lives. A calming influence, great entertainment, somebody who we felt, you know, great love for and hope, as, you know, in the senses I've been talking about, that he loved us back, mm-hmm. certainly seemed to. As I say in the book, sometimes people cry harder for the loss of a pet than they do a loss of a human, even somebody they love dearly. A couple of reasons for that. I think one is that a relationship with a dog is less complicated.
Yeah.
Every human relationship has shades of nuances, and you don't really argue with a dog the way you might.
Well, people make you angry.
People make you angry.
Yeah.
Secondly, I think it inverts the normal process. As if you think of a dog human as like a parent-child relationship, your kids are not supposed to die before you do. And so when a dog dies, a pet dies, somebody that in our case we raised literally from the first weeks of his life to the very end, we saw basically his whole life. You know, that can be really devastating in a way that it's not when it's your parents or something like that. The way I put it is I have deeper feelings for the humans in my life that died. But in the moment, the death of a pet can feel harder.
Because their love is unconditional,
and
there's no baggage.
There's no baggage,
And anything that they do that might make you temporarily irritated is not because they did it maliciously.
Well, and this is one case where the language barrier is actually kind of useful.
Yeah.
You never know if your dog didn't like you.
Right.
Right?
You had a bond with Fred. What did you learn about the bond between these show dogs and their handlers, or these show dogs and their owners, or just the whole general idea of a bond between a dog and a human by traveling to these dog shows?
Well, as I said earlier, I think we sort of tamed them and they sort of tamed us. We domesticated them. They domesticated us. We are the reason for their existence because we created every dog that's ever existed, a human bred from a gray wolf somewhere. And I think in some ways, they invented us as well.
Tommy Tomlinson, a great book. It is beautifully written. And if you are a dog lover, you will love this book. Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Tommy, thank you for the hour again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks. A writer who reviewed my book for the Washington Post said that one thing it's about, one thing that dogs teach us, is how to say goodbye. I think that's right. But I also think they teach us how to say hello. Is there any creature on earth more excited than a dog when its people come home? And why aren't we excited when our people come home? Somewhere down the line, a lot of us learn to stuff our feelings deep down inside, as if they were contagions that might infect somebody if they got out. Most dogs have no such inhibitions. They'll come right up to you and lick your face, sniff your crotch, prop their paws on your thighs, and make it absolutely clear how glad they are to see you. We humans should probably hold off on the face licking, much less the crotch sniffing. But it can't hurt to take a lesson from dogs and let the people we care about know how much we care about them. Affection is not some rare treasure to be hoarded. We should spend it like we're in a Vegas casino. All you have to do to see how much that kind of affection lights up a room is to watch a dog. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.